then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's October the 30th, 2014. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. All right, now I'm going to begin with a somewhat extensive housekeeping or inside baseball segment, which has become necessary. And I'm going to tell you two stories from recent events in the racially conscious community which seem to completely contradict one another. And I'll be honest with you, I could use some help in resolving the contradiction. I have spoken in the past about the internal debate we have in the NF and just about everybody else in our wee little movement has going on formalization versus cellular organization, otherwise known as Rotary Club versus Secret Squirrel, or sometimes Rotary Club versus Loosey Goosey. Now, the main advantage of Rotary Club formalization with membership cards and secret decoder rings is that we can start issuing formal memberships for which we demand, not politely await, that $10 a month in dues from each of you. Now, let's say I could persuade or browbeat 3,000 of the more or less 5,000 of you who listen to the program every week to join an actual organization and pay $10 a month dues and $100 twice a year for the fall and spring fund appeals for a total of $320 a year. That's almost $1 million a year. That is our revolution financed. And most of you spend three times more than that every year for car insurance. So it's not a matter of you can't afford it. If you're honestly so stone broke that you can't afford $10 a month for the 14 words, you need to withdraw from racial activity of any kind and spend your online time looking for a job or searching government benefit sites or whatever you have to do in order to get your act together so that you can contribute something to the racial struggle. But, as I said, we now have two cautionary tales which illustrate the risks of both the Rotary Club and the loosey-goosey secret squirrel approach. Really, guys, we need to work out something that resolves the apparent contradiction here, and I would be grateful for some serious and mature and considered feedback. First off, illustrating the fundamental weakness of voluntarism, or loosey-goosey, or whatever you want to call it, I am now once again, more or less, out of those fold-over brochures that everybody was so impressed with a while back. The ones entitled, What Will It Take to Get Rid of the Racial Equality Lie? Probably because it actually has some pictures and some color on it. When the writer of the brochure ran off enough color copies on his own printer for us to send them out with the Northwest Observer a couple of months ago, everybody just fell excitedly in love with them. I got literally dozens of people emailing me saying, Dear Harold, send me X number of those brochures and I swear on a stack of Bibles and a stack of Mein Kampfs, I will actually pass them out and I won't just stick them in the cardboard box in the bottom of my closet where I keep all my racial material for my collection. And by the by, I am not implying that these comrades are in any way insincere or that they're trying to be duplicitous in some weird movement way. I'm sure that they're entirely ready to pass out anything the NF can send them for free. And yes, I understand that regardless of what I just finished saying about people needing to drop out and get their act together and come back when you can afford $10 a month in dues, almost none of you are going to actually do that because the internet is free and you're going to keep on hanging around so you can get your racism fix and the satisfaction of fooling yourself that you're part of something larger than yourself and you're doing your duty. You're not, but you are what Zion has made you, and while it's my duty to try and get you to change, I understand that most of you never will. I have to play the cards I'm dealt. I understand that some of you are too genuinely poor to pay for literature in bulk, and I'll be completely honest with you, I was once in the same boat myself, so please don't think I'm completely lacking in empathy like I keep telling you guys. I get all this stuff you're dealing with because I have, in fact, been through most of it myself over the past few decades. Now, in the 80s and the 90s, I had the same half-assed arrangement with Dr. Ed Fields. At one stage, he was offering 100 back issues of the Truth at Last newspaper for $25 plus shipping, so say about 30 bucks. I was doing minimum wage crap work for the temp agencies, and very seldom 40 hours of it per week, and I was genuinely, for real, too broke to afford even that price. So, this being the days before the internet, I had to write to Ed and tell him, "Look, I'm sorry, I am totally busted flat here, so here's the deal. Anything you can send me for free, from pamphlets to back numbers of the paper, lay it on me, and I will make sure it gets into the community here in Raleigh or Seattle or San Antonio, wherever I was at the time, and I will mail them out with my own intro packs of resistance newsletters and whatnot." Now, every now and then, Ed would send me a big padded envelope with about 20 or 25 Truth at Lasts in it, and I got them out. Now, recently, a very enthusiastic comrade in Maryland saw the sample of the brochure that we sent out a few Northwest Observers ago. He was so enthralled with them that he ordered them in bulk. He sent me 50 bucks for basically all I had, and even with a recent refreshment of our inventory from the creator of the brochure, I still could not supply all this Maryland comrade wanted. So, we're all out of brochures, again. And since the Northwest Front lacks a budget or a regular source of income or a professionalized propaganda department, I have no idea when the guy who created the brochure will get around to running off another 30 or 40 of them on his own full-color printer off his computer and folding them and sending them to me. I sent out the frontal and reverse templates for this piece of propaganda by email attachment some time ago. I imagine most of you simply deleted the email. "Oh, that's just more junk from Harold, and I don't have to mess with it now," that kind of thing. I do know that no one else is making these brochures, at least not that they've let me know about. Aside from Northwest Observer mailings, and assuming that the Maryland guy keeps his word, we have now actually distributed maybe 100 of these slowly handmade items outside of our own small Northwest Front circle. And since the Maryland guy, to my knowledge, has his own small circle of already converted racially conscious individuals, who will almost certainly be the recipients of what I sent him, the likelihood is that as yet, after almost 6 months in existence, not one single muggle, by which I mean not one unawakened so-called average normal white person in the white community itself, has seen a single copy of this brochure yet. We have passed it around among ourselves like little boys of 9 or 10 used to pass around a Playboy centerfold that someone had torn out of their father or big brother's copy. And that's a pity, because it's a good little brochure. It was designed to awaken and interest and convert completely new normal white people. It is exactly what we need, but we do not have the funds or the organization or the boots on the ground to inject it into the more or less normal, non-movement white community, which is where we must start drawing our human resources from. Formalization and the receipt of a regular dues-based income where we could do things like projecting a budget would be the first step in acquiring these things. I should be ordering these brochures in case lots of 50,000 copies each and sending each one of you a quota of 100 per week or so with orders to get these items into the white community, the unawakened, normal community. Instead, I have to wait until this one man has the time and inclination and money for ink cartridges and shipping to print off 40 or 50 copies of the brochure on his printer, after which I can start to send them out with the intro packs again. Now, in our present state, the NF is like medieval monks fighting to preserve knowledge and spread enlightenment with the modern technological equivalent of quill and parchment. Unfortunately, quill and parchment just won't do. Not only do we need the money and the foot soldiers to distribute actual physical literature in the white communities of the Northwest, but we need the money to hire and put to work full-time the people with the technical, IT, and media skills to make sure that our message is heard by more than our usual 5,000 people per week. So, that's one for the pro-Rotary Club column. But something happened last week which presents a flip side to it. Now, I'm not going to go over the long and sad tale of the National Alliance since the death of its founder, Dr. William L. Pierce. But I will explain, for those of you who don't keep up with all these movement soap operas, that the buzzards who descended on the carcass of the NA after Pierce's death and started rending and tearing at it are now down to the main course, the 330-acre compound in the remote mountains of West Virginia, although I understand it's now down to 290 acres, with all kinds of buildings and offices and warehouse space and probably still a large amount of NA inventory, books and periodicals, equipment, plant, music CDs, so forth and so on. To make a long, stupid, and complex story short, there are now two factions vying for control of this property, which is probably worth a little over $1 million as it stands, and one of them filed a lawsuit over it. On October 24th, a judge in Virginia ordered the defendants to turn over to the rival faction all membership records and financial information they wanted to look over in preparation for what's called discovery. Now, this is only one way in which formalized organizations are vulnerable and are completely unable to maintain any kind of confidentiality or privacy for their members or supporters. Everyone who has ever been a member of the National Alliance, or who has ever donated a single dollar, or who has ever purchased a single book or CD will now have their personal information become part of the public record of a court case. Anyone with 25 cents per page for copying costs will be able to walk away from the clerk of court's office with a copy of the National Alliance membership list in their briefcase. Now, there was, in fact, a delegation from the Southern Poverty Law Center present at the court hearing on Thursday, so they're watching this case, and I think we can assume that the minute the defendant faction complies with the judge's order, some lawyer from the SPLC will be down at the clerk of court's office with his checkbook out. There are other ways that this can happen as well, through criminal cases or congressional investigations or just plain outright FBI or police raids that seize files and hard drives. There's nothing we can do about that, but at least we should try to maintain some pretense that we are not a Rotary Club. We're genuine revolutionaries who actually understand the need to conceal who we are and what we're doing from the very dictatorship that we're trying to remove from power. Now, I will not go into the details of how we do things here at the Batcave, but I will say that the paperwork of all kinds is kept to an absolute necessary minimum, and that steps are taken to shield anything with a name and address on it. In this age of electronic communications and the revelations of Edward Snowden, this may be pretty futile, especially since most likely the dictatorship has repeatedly hacked into my computer already without a warrant and stolen all the data on there. But at least the Northwest Front tries to protect your privacy, even though it sometimes hampers us. And I'll give you an example. I send out a lot of intro packets every week, and sometimes I'll get an email saying, "Dear Harold, thank you for the introductory packs, both of them. Why did you send me a second one?" Or, "Where is my intro pack I asked for 3 weeks ago?" You see, I used to keep a written list of who I'd sent what to precisely and when, so that my aging and increasingly senile memory wouldn't forget. I don't do that anymore because I'm simply too uncomfortable with having a list of names lying around on my work table, even if most of them are only looky-loos we'll never hear from again. We have to maintain at least a pretense that we're serious about all this. There must never be anything anywhere in existence that even remotely resembles such a thing as a Northwest Front membership list. It's simply too dangerous precisely because we are serious. So, how do we strike a balance? Now, it would be nice if 3,000 or 4,000 of you guys who listen to this program every week would suddenly experience a transfiguration of character and voluntarily devote your lives, your fortunes, and your sacred honor to the Northwest American Republic without the need for formal structure and application forms and membership cards and formal hierarchies of the kind that you're familiar with in American society, without needing these things to prop you up psychologically and overcome your natural American timidness. Well, if wishes were horses, then beggars would ride. Okay, this is our official Halloween podcast, and every October we generally look for some ghostly Halloween-y type music. Now, I don't know how many of you ever got into the vampire craze, but I am admittedly something of a Dracula fan as regards the literary aspect of it. There have been God knows how many Dracula movies made down through the years, only one of which ever came anywhere even close to following the book, and that wasn't very close. That was the one with Gary Oldman and Anthony Hopkins and Keanu Reeves, God help us. It was called Bram Stoker's Dracula, and the opening theme was pretty cool. Anyway, enough navel-gazing. Here's the conclusion of last week's bout of dueling codgers.
Well, I couldn't agree with that more. Trust me, the minute they perceive you've got the cable TV company and the Jews don't, they'll be coming up here in droves. Not to be sarcastic or anything like that. But yeah, that's exactly what they'll do. And the mass of the white people in this country are so degenerated to such a state that basically it's like people watching a badminton game. They'll watch that bird go back and forth, and wherever they think it's going to land, they'll all move to that side of the stadium.
Yeah.
But that's neither here nor there right now. The main thing for moving up here right now, to me, is the fact that the socialization. You can actually hang out with people who think like you do, and you can talk openly and not get arrested or lose your job or all that stuff. Plus, it's a really nice place to live. I've lived all over the world, and I'm telling you, there's only one place nicer than this place, and it's way too far out in the sticks to be practical. But even the people here that are not racially conscious are still 99% believe what we believe. They haven't, and in fact, if they were allowed to speak their mind, I'm pretty sure they're pretty racially conscious anyway.
Oh, yeah.
Just from their comments. But it's the socialization. I mean, I don't know why people insist on living in the rest of the country where you're basically living in your own little cocoon socially. That drove me nuts.
Well, this part of the country is going to be the last part of North America, if you include, say, British Columbia, Alberta, maybe,
yeah.
maybe Alaska. It's going to be the last part of the country that is livable. It is going to be the last part of the country that in any way, shape, or form resembles the traditional United States as we knew it, or as we know it, put it that way.
Yeah, no, I agree totally. And, you know, like the housing bubble, right? I mean, it hit pretty hard here in Seattle. When I was living here, the suburban cities were actually building city-run tent farms for all the middle-class people who were kicked out of their houses because they couldn't pay the mortgage. But east of the Cascades, and especially east of the mountains are, they're not part of the Rocky Mountains, the housing bubble never hit at all. Where I live, a few people got foreclosed on and they just refused to sell their houses anyway. The building slowed down a little bit, but then it, like last year, it picked up and people are building houses like crazy.
Well, where you are, basically people buy houses to live in, not flip, and not to use as an ATM cash machine for themselves.
Well, that's a good point. Mm-hmm. People out here are a lot more industrious. People still start small businesses and they're still successful at it. And there's, compared to a lot of places, there's not as much government regulation, although they're busily trying to do something about that. What I mean is, compared to all the other places I've been, this is a Shangri-La.
Yeah.
Anyway, you know, economically, amount of personal freedom we have, the infrastructure, and mostly just the wide open spaces. I mean, except for the narrow band up the I-5, the rest of the country's empty.
Yeah, right. Well, even the weather is not as bad as it. Like, I'm looking out our window here, and I'm seeing nice yellow and red fall leaves, although it's kind of cloudy. Just, again, for those of you who think you might miss the beautiful fall colors and, you know, maybe you're part of the East Coast or whatever, I will match the fall color here in the Northwest against anything in Vermont or the Appalachians, but with one proviso or with one caveat, and that is that there's not as much of it. Well, there's a lot more evergreens up here, but what fall color we have here is really nice. And can you guys think of anything else you want to?
Well, recently I read an article about the movement of whites out of the urban cities and how basically it's been pushed and engineered that way. So let's take Ferguson. And in the headlines recently, for an example, I guess in the 90s, it was mostly white, and over the time that's lapsed, pushed more blacks into the area, thus causing the whites to move out of the area.
Right.
So one of my points is, if you're going to do white flight, might as well make a jump that's going to count. Move up here.
No, I agree totally.
Yeah. What's the point in moving to some suburb 30 miles away from the problem? Because basically, the niggers, the Mexicans are going to follow you. Eventually, in the long term, of course, they'll follow us up here. That is the nature of parasites. They can't live without their host. Wherever the white man flees in this country, they will follow, which is why we have got to take a stand and genuinely resist here in the homeland. Because if we do nothing, it's not just a matter of coming here to the homeland and buying a nice house and getting a nice job and living the middle-class Brady Bunch lifestyle. Because, yes, they will follow. I'm sure I know the percentage of non-whites in the Northwest is higher than it was 10 years ago, precisely because we have a prosperous, stable white society here, and we have all the things that the non-whites like to consume. Basically, they like to get on the white man's back and ride, and for that they need a white man who is fairly stable and prosperous himself. But the thing is that we get what we call short stops sometimes in the NF. These guys said, yeah, I'm going to come out. I'm going to migrate. I'm going to come to the Northwest homeland. And they come, and they end up in the North Dakota shale fracking fields, or in Salt Lake City, or in Denver. No, you need to come all the way to the actual homeland, Washington, Oregon, Idaho, Montana, west of Interstate 15, which is right now the official homeland, because that's small enough to be manageable.
And also, as one of the thoughts I had recently is, we've got these initiatives in this Washington, you'll have to excuse me, I'm recently from New York, love it up here, by the way. What's the propositions where people can put things on for ballot vote?
Mm-hmm.
What's it called? Yeah.
Initiative, I thought.
Initiative? One thing is, when we get enough people up here, we can put on something there for protective covenants to keep areas white, to keep areas like Paulsbo, which is Danish, Norwegian, keep that influence there and not dilute it.
The problem with anything, any plan like that done within the framework of the present United States is that anytime local people, as witness these people of Idaho who did not want gay marriage, anytime local people, local state authorities, local courts, state courts do something that basically the liberal left-wing powers that be in Washington don't like, something that doesn't fit the agenda, they just go running to the federal courts as fast as their bandy little legs can carry them and get it overturned or overrule it in some way. This is why there has to be sovereign independence. We have to have our own country where we are the courts, we are the government, and we run things.
Well, I mean, I couldn't agree with that more. But in the meantime, think about it. There's enough people that think like us in Idaho that they managed to pass a voter initiative.
Mm-hmm.
That means more voters didn't want it than voters did.
Mm-hmm.
Where else can you get, except the Pacific Northwest, can you get that many people that think like you do?
Mm-hmm.
And they're already here. Well, all we need is missionaries, right?
Yeah.
We need, even the local people need to be proselytized. They,
absolutely. I wish I could get more people active out here doing local recruiting.
Well, I think we should start a bedsheet war.
Okay, what's a bedsheet war?
Buy hundreds of used bedsheets, like 10 cents a pound, right? You know, big bedsheets, right?
Right?
You paint signs on them and hang them off overpasses. You can, like, do it by 30 or 40 of them in a night. It's great.
We had
it's
some,
a cheap way to...
We had some folks doing that down in Oregon. I'm not quite sure why they stopped.
Right.
But, well, actually, apparently... Well, I won't get into that. But, look, I do what I can sitting here behind my computer right now, which is all I can do. The Republic has to have groups of people who live here, communities of people who live here, who go out and do these things independently on their own. I think there is somehow or other gotten to be some kind of diffused impression that I don't approve of any kind of public activism. What I don't approve of is guys dressing up in costumes and standing on a street corner with a sign and getting their photographs taken by the local police and local Southern Poverty Law Center stringer. That I don't approve of because, you see, we've tried those tactics and it doesn't work. But that does not mean that I am against people doing things in public like the bedsheet things. It's you guys out there. You have to do it. I can't do all this for you. Sometimes I think we have this sort of idea in the NF that if I am not physically present and I'm not giving you my blessing like the Pope or my benediction and swinging my censer and saying, you know, Pax Vobiscum or whatever, that you're not supposed to do anything. No, no, we got to wait for Harold. No, you don't have to wait for Harold. It's not that I'm against all public activism. It's just that I can't be there for everybody. And one thing I keep telling people, you don't need my permission. If you have an idea about something that you want to do for the NF that you think will advance the 14 words and the cause of the Northwest Republic, you don't have to ask me. Just do it. I know most of you and I trust most of you enough to believe that you won't do anything that's just really totally horrible or anything. But the fact is that somebody has got to start taking some initiative around here besides me because I just can't do it all by myself. And so look, if you guys have these ideas that you want to try, don't just sit and talk about them and talking about, well, we better go ask Harold. No, just do it. Surprise me. I love being surprised by Northwest Front activism. I like nothing better than coming in the morning and logging onto my computer and saying, I wonder what the guys were up to last night. I wonder what I'm going to see here by way of tricolor flags appearing or graffiti or bedsheets or cards in the mail or whatever, or littering, leaflets on lawns.
Back in the good old days, around at night throwing flyers, and just a couple of people would sit around for 3 or 4 hours and roll flyers. Literally roll like garbage sacks full of them. And then with about 2 or 3 teams would just drive around town throwing them on people's lawns.
We used to do that back in the day in Raleigh. We'd spend like a whole day at the headquarters, 6 or 8 of us rolling Truth at Last newspapers and leaflets, rubber banding them, in some cases putting them in plastic bags. We'd take them out. We'd use pickup trucks. One guy would be in the back of a pickup truck, tossing them on lawns at about like midnight on Saturday. Yeah. And we could get rid of 10,000 papers in an hour with, say, 2 or 3 trucks.
Yeah.
It was that fast.
No, absolutely. And after every time we did that, we would get people, we'd get checks in the mail. You know, people just write us a check and put it in the mail. I mean, you know, yeah, you'd raise the usual amount of canned publicity. There'd always be the right. outraged homeowner on the local TV station.
And Mark Protok, of course.
Yeah. Oh, and he, yeah, that guy too, you know, the head spit licker. But it generated not only publicity, but it positive publicity. And we, like I said, people actually would just write us out a check and mail it to the post office box. Mm-hmm. People would show up, join up. And a lot of people just wanted to be supportive, right? Mm-hmm. It was amazing. And even people that didn't 100% agree with us. All it took was a lot of just effort. I mean, mm-hmm. money-wise, it was pretty cheap to get to about 500 leaflets printed up at Kinko's. But it just took grunts on the ground who were willing to drive around all night throwing leaflets. And actually, it can be pretty exciting. A lot of really crazy things happened when we were doing it. Luckily, none of it involved getting arrested. So.
Okay. I've got almost 40 minutes now. That'll be enough.
Good evening, comrades. Tonight I'm going to talk about David Duke's My Awakening. Now, of course, this book has been available for many years. Recently, Harold sent it to me, and I decided to read it. Now, of course, this book doesn't necessarily say anything that you don't already know, but it's very thorough, and in that I was very impressed with it. This is a combination of autobiographical and, of course, social commentary. So first of all, we have Duke growing up in the Bayou country of Louisiana. His father is in the military, and his mother is a housewife, and unfortunately, she sadly has a drinking problem, and that was made worse when her sister dies in a plane crash. Now, Duke has aspirations. He wants to be a scientist or an astronaut, but he's also drawn to the White Citizens Council. At first, he's struggling with issues of integration in schools, which was an issue when he was growing up. And at first, he believes that he might be for integration because he's altruistic, but he is drawn to the Citizens Council, and he reads Carl Putnam's Race and Reason. And he begins to study the issue of IQ inheritance. He wants to know, why are some countries poor? And really talks about all the various studies that he read. Now, the book also goes into Southern history to a certain degree and talks about demographic changes and social movements after 1965. And, of course, the role of Jews in social critique movements. Duke also gets into the dangerous ground of historical revision. Really, the book takes a great many aspects of socio-racial questions and puts them all in one place. So, very much you can find a lot in this book to the point where your thinking may be altered to a degree that it might actually be dangerous for you, because he really lays out the truth very starkly. Duke very much wanted to please his father, so much so that in 1966 he spends a year in military school, but he reads Yaqui in his free time. By 17, he returns to New Orleans. Now, the book doesn't really go into too much detail as to why he returns to New Orleans, but it seems that Duke found a military school to be not entirely to his liking, and when he was able to do so, when he was old enough to make up his own mind, he returns to public school. He doesn't really like public school, but apparently he prefers it to military school. Really, Duke has to work his way through school. His father does not want him to be a slackard. He ends up having a paper route, and at one point, he has a car accident that could have been fairly serious. So he decides to really give his life to the cause, and he decides that the Citizens Council is too passive. So at this point, Duke has a mentor in James Lindsay and decides that he will join the Klan. He will join James Lindsay's Klan. But he finds that this is also something of a social club. And at this point, he starts a bit of a flirtation with Rockwell. Now, he corresponds with Rockwell and is for a moment influenced, but he never joins the National Socialists. And again, this was at the behest of his father, who makes him promise not to do so. Now, Duke starts getting involved in some campus activism, and Duke finds that he has to work his way to the Louisiana State University. Now, once at the university, David joins the ROTC, which is compulsory for all male students at that time, but he would have joined anyway. He wants to prove himself, and he also wants to please his father, but he continues to speak out, and he becomes really very outspoken. He starts something called the White Youth Alliance, and also a newspaper. He's so active that he's asked to move off campus during his sophomore year. Now, at around the same time, Duke is told that he is not accepted into the advanced ROTC because he has been so vocal that really at this point no branch of the service will take him. But he's told that he can still serve. He can be an instructor at an American language school. So Duke goes to Laos. For a short time, he does work as an instructor at a school. But one day, Duke goes on a plane ride with his father, and apparently the plane crosses into a zone where there's still some combat going on in Southeast Asia, and the plane comes under some fire, and Duke is almost hit. And at this point, Duke realizes that he's really not suited to combat. I think that Duke comes to just a decision or a clarity that really he's not interested in Southeast Asia and probably doesn't care about what kind of government they have there, even though he's not for communism. But at any rate, then he goes on a bit of a world tour. He goes to India and he sees the sometimes attractive remnants of a society that's been destroyed by race mixing. Then, for whatever reason, I really don't know why, Duke goes to Israel, which is really very foolish. And while in Israel, for whatever reason, he gets food poisoning. And then he recovers in Greece. Then he moves on to Italy, where he meets with the Italian social movement. But when he gets to Northern Europe, he's really visiting his spiritual home. So he visits Germany, goes to see the statue of Hermann, and he's sympathetic to the Germans, but he sees that strategic mistakes were made and pulls historical parties to account. Now, at this point, Duke decides not to finish college, and he decides to get involved with something called the National Party. This group becomes very popular, and at around this time, the National Party is accused of stealing campaign pamphlets and other paraphernalia from the Wallace campaign. Eventually, Duke goes to jail for a short time, but he's not charged because really they were not stealing anything. But at this point, he really reassesses his life and he's decided he's going to go back to college and complete his degree. And he also decides that he's going to get married to Chloe, his faithful girlfriend, who was also in jail with him. And so the couple spends some time in the Northwest. And after that, Duke considers whether or not to stay in the Northwest, but he decides to return to Louisiana to modernize the Klan. He does that for a time, and then he travels to Britain. He meets with the Nationalist Front, and he gets tons of publicity. So he's very successful in modernizing the Klan, but the downside is that a lot of groups can call themselves the Klan, and they may do things that Duke doesn't necessarily support. So at this point, he changes strategies, and anyone who's followed Duke might remember the National Association for the Advancement of White People. So that's what he gets involved in. Now, later, this organization changes its name to European Americans Unity and Rights Organization. Eventually, Duke is drawn into this idea of trying to go somewhat mainstream. This is when he was in the Louisiana legislature. He endures slander and many tax audits. He talks about how he really wishes for a nation with few laws, but with lots of honor, honesty, and a lot of integrity. Duke rejoices in the coming of the internet. Of course, he's writing this in the late 90s. At this point, he has been corresponding, I guess throughout his life, or through many years at least, has been corresponding with Dr. Shockley. Shockley says that he doesn't care about his inventions unless whites survive. He would give away his Nobel Prize and all of that if it could help whites to survive. Duke says that whites really need strategies that are similar to the strategies that Jewish people use. He talks about how Jews have always stressed education, intelligence, successful large families, history, culture, and tradition, and worked as a team, but still stressing individual responsibility. And they speak out against intermarriage and use power on behalf of own people. Duke talks about the cause, generally speaking, and he really asks people to live for the cause, to live a life of hard work. Now, he talks about his involvement with politics and says that politics mutes revolution, because politics is about compromise, and you end up rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. He says that supporters should give time and money to openly pro-white organizations, and he talks about the Awakening Project, and he gives a website. Now, I don't know how much of that is current, but I know he's still on the web. He says that really the movement is as much a concern for liberals as it is for conservatives. I found this book very interesting. Again, I think it's a book that could alter certain ideas about history. For example, he's always backing up whatever facts that he talks about, and he makes some excellent points and some very, very seaworthy arguments. And so if you haven't read this classic book, then I would recommend that you do so, because in so many ways it's one-stop shopping. Well, thank you for listening to my review, and hail victory, comrades.
This may not actually be a Halloween song. I heard it in Ireland when I was living over there. It's a rather strange little ditty, and I asked some of the local people exactly what it was about, and no one seemed to be quite sure. Some said that it was about a mischievous child. Some said it was about the ghost of a mischievous child that is visiting or haunting someone. Some said it was about a leprechaun or a fairy of some kind. Anyway, it's not exactly horrifying, it's just kind of strange. This is the Dubliners with Stockton's Wing.
That's knocking the door to me. Who is that there? That's knocking the door to me. Who is that there? That's knocking the door to me. Only myself is cool. Cool, dear, don't come any nearer me. Cool, dear, don't come any nearer me. Cool, dear, don't come any nearer me. Maybe I shouldn't say cool. Who is that there that's tapping the window pane? Who is that there that's tapping the window pane? Who is that there that's tapping the window pane? Only myself is cool. Cool, dear, don't come any nearer me. Cool, dear, don't come any nearer me. Cool, dear, don't come any nearer me. Maybe I shouldn't say cool. Who is that there that's climbing the stairs to me? Who is that there that's climbing the stairs to me? Who is that there that's climbing the stairs to me? Only myself, says Coonla. Coonla dear, don't come any nearer me. Coonla dear, don't come any nearer me. Coonla dear, don't come any nearer me. Maybe I shouldn't, says Coonla. That's pulling the blankets down. Who is that there? That's pulling the blankets down. Who is that there? That's pulling the blankets down. Only myself, says Coonla. Coonla dear, don't come any nearer me. Coonla dear, don't come any nearer me. Coonla dear, don't come any nearer me. Maybe I shouldn't, says Coonla. Who is that there that's tickling the toes of me? Who is that there that's tickling the toes of me? Who is that there that's tickling the toes of me? Only myself, says Coonla. Coonla dear, don't come any nearer me. Coonla dear, don't come any nearer me. Coonla dear, don't come any nearer me. Maybe I shouldn't, says Coonla. Who is that there that's tickling the toes of me? Who is that there that's tickling the toes of me? Who is that there that's tickling the toes of me? Only myself, says Coonla. Coonla dear, don't come any nearer me. Coonla dear, don't come any nearer me. Coonla dear, don't come any nearer me. Maybe I shouldn't, says Coonla. That's wrecking the fire for me. Who is that there? That's wrecking the fire for me. Who is that there? That's wrecking the fire for me. Only myself, says Coonla. Coonla dear, don't come any nearer me. Coonla dear, don't come any nearer me. Coonla dear, don't come any nearer me. Yet maybe I shouldn't, says Coonla.
This is a cut from an interview that I did on Sunday, October 26th, with Joe Adams on the White Voice podcast.
All right, welcome back. The White Voice number 76. We're here. It's been a while since we had him on. Our summer hiatus went by, and I was thinking, oh, who are we going to talk to? And this Mike Brown thing that we've been talking about here tonight provides us a good opportunity to talk about this issue of white people having a land of their own. And we all know that if white people had a land of their own, white racist cops would not be shooting unarmed black children carrying sandwiches and that sort of thing. So joining us today, the author of so many books, I don't even think I should bother even listing them. If you don't know them already, you got to go look them up. Freedom Sons, Distant Thunder, all these books. Northwestfront.org, Harold Covington. How are you, Harold?
Pretty good, Joe.
Good, good.
Glad to be here.
Good. So we see, and I noticed you used a term, I think you kind of rubbed off on me, space madness, because that's really what it seems like is going on in Ferguson, that no matter what the facts say, no matter what the forensics say or the autopsy says, people are going to be, and I think I've actually been the first person to use this phrase, they're going to be objectively black. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
If a black person is the perceived victim of something because of the way the media covers something, that instantly means that the white racist cop is at fault. And he didn't do nothings. I have a theory on the show that I should bring you up to speed on quickly. It's that no matter what, no matter the circumstance, whether it was the guy in Staten Island, New York, or Mike Brown, or Trayvon Martin, they didn't do nothings. And that's the mm-hmm. exact phrase the parents use when they get on this. So that's my theory, the Joe Adams theory on black behavior, the didn't do nothings theory. So Harold, what are we seeing here? Obviously, we know that this kid was on drugs. He used the N-word in his raps, talking about killing people. He was just getting his life back on track, right, Harold?
Right, yeah. I believe he'd also just robbed a convenience store mm-hmm. of some Swisher Sweet cigars, which apparently, I didn't know this until the story hit. Apparently, you can basically take the tobacco out of those cigars and leave the casing intact, and they make really big joints. So,
yeah, the blunts.
Yeah, that, I basically think that this Ferguson thing is part of the Democratic effort for the 2014 midterm elections, just like Occupy Wall Street was for the 2012 general election. It's clearly being kept alive by, pardon the expression, outside agitators. I know every time something happens, the local mayor and whatnot goes on TV and says, well, it's just outside agitators. That's an old term from, 50 years ago. But in this case, it does seem to be accurate. the vast majority of those demonstrators in Ferguson reading between the lines come from outside the country. If you follow, outside the city. And if you follow the left-wing blogs like I do, you can see that they are really pumping up this cause in Ferguson, so forth and so on. This has all the earmarks of a deliberate provocateur action on the part of the liberal left in order to gin up the Democrat base for the elections, which are coming in about 10 days' time. So that's what's going on here. I suspect very strongly that after the elections, Ferguson will quietly disappear, because apparently the evidence now does indicate that this huge, monstrous monkoid did, in fact, attack the police officer in his car, was trying to get his gun, and he did rob a convenience store, and he was high on grass. And, you know, even to liberal lefties, this is not exactly the stuff of martyrs.
But that's the thing, Harold. When we look at this situation, I think it makes it different from the Trayvon Martin situation. Number one, because the officer is undeniably blonde hair, probably has blue eyes. He's a white man, whereas Zimmerman was a fat mestizo of some kind of racial admixture. I think he has black in him somewhere. He was not white, no matter what the media wanted to say. But the difference I'm noticing here with the Ferguson events is that white people are actually starting to stand up. And sure, you have the white Marxist agitators. You have the kosher communists that are organizing this. I'm sure Acorn has a hand in this somewhere along the line. Of course, the usual suspects like Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson, and so on. But what are you making of, and I think it's kind of undeniable, that there is a white resistance to this nonsense. Shortly after the initial riots and protests, we saw a group, I think it was a couple, at least a few dozen, it might have even been 100, I really don't want to say off the top of my head, but it was a substantial amount of white people who stood there with their Support Darren Wilson t-shirts.
Right.
What does this say about the growing racial consciousness, not just on this issue, but across America amongst white people? They're starting to get it, do you think?
Oh, definitely, definitely. I know I've been in the movement for a long time, and we always had this sort of depressing mantra among ourselves. Oh, these people will never wake up. Mm-hmm. What is wrong with them? They're just so lazy and so stupid and blah, blah, blah. But I don't know. Maybe it took the election of Obama in 2008 to finally strike the spark. I think this past 6 years, white people have all of a sudden come to realize that we are now a minority in our own land, and that we are being ruled by third world tyranny, and you know, nobody has a job anymore, at least none that pays worth anything, and people are losing their houses, and you know, more and more white people are descending into poverty. The white middle class is disappearing. There is simply no more Brady Bunch. The liberal left killed it. And so I think finally that moment that we have been waiting for 40 years, when all of this BS is actually touching most white people individually in some way. Finally, we are reaching that point where everybody is suffering. Mm-hmm. Every white person in this country knows someone who has been victimized by a loss of a job, the loss of a home, crushing student loan debt, black crime, loss of jobs to illegal aliens, violence from illegal aliens, people who shouldn't even be here. Finally, that stuff is becoming so pervasive that it is touching just about everybody in the white community. And at long last, I think we are seeing the first stirrings of that awakening that people like me have been spending our whole lives waiting for.
Yeah.
It's definitely, you can tell a difference even between now and even 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm. I remember a couple weeks ago, I was actually talking to somebody who, just looking at them, physically speaking, you would assume white, pot-smoking communist, diversity lover, and they get it, Harold. I mean, I was honest, and they get it. They understand the need for our people coming together. If anything, coming together to express that, you know what the hell, we do have interests, look what's happening. So, but let me ask you this about these media scandals, and I want to talk about the way media cover Ferguson, but let's save that for right after this. What do you make of these, it almost seems like bi-weekly media racism scandals? We saw it at Justin Bieber, there was a video of him out a while ago. There was, what's that one's name? Taylor Swift, they were talking about the racial undertones in her video. Of course, you have Donald Tokowitz, Donald Sterling, who is a mensch when he donates money to the NAACP, but is a white man when he doesn't want blacks at his ball games.
Right.
A very other undercover story was the owner of the Atlanta Hawks, also a Jewish man who resigned from ownership of his team because there was incriminating emails. Of course, we can go back to Paula Deen. We get the point. Every week or every other week, it seems like there's a new race scandal What do you think the media's motive behind making these race scandals are, and is it having a possible opposite effect of what they intend it to be?
Yes, it is, I'm sure, having at least some degree of unintended consequences for them. I advocate that my people actually read blogs like Salon Magazine, Huffington Post, The Daily Beast, and so forth and so on, as sickening as it is for them, because there you will see the entire liberal left agenda spread out for you. If there was ever any doubt in your mind as to what these people intend to do with the world that they have seized, then that will resolve it. And because I read these blogs, I am able to get a sort of a sense of what they're trying to do. They are, number one, attempting to make sure that the Democrat Party stays in power forever. And a large part of all that we see going on in this country right now has to do with the efforts of the Democrats to create a one-party state. For example, we now know that they've contracted for 34 million new green cards for when Obama amnesties all of the illegal aliens in December after the elections. And eventually, what they're trying to create here in this country, Joe, is a one-party state with a token opposition in some kind of parliamentary party that will be the what's left of the Republicans. It will be like the PRI in Mexico. I don't know if you're familiar with what happened in Mexico after the revolutions they had in the 1920s, but for almost 70 years, Mexico was a one-party state, effectively. That's the situation they're trying to create here. All of the things that they're trying to do has to do with a grab for power. Liberals are the most power-hungry bastards you will ever want to meet in your life. They want to control people. They want to control money. They want to control things. They want to sit there behind their computers and in their little ivory towers in their boardrooms and in the faculty lounge, and they want to tell everyone else in this country how to live their lives. That is the ultimate goal, tactically speaking.
Harold, do you remember the Kathleen Parker article from probably late last year where they were talking about thought control, controlling your thoughts?
That one doesn't ring a bell. I'm sorry.
She said that what we need to do is participate in thought editing. And I know you're a big 1984 guy, the George Orwell novel.
You're referring to. Yeah. I don't remember that particular article, but I've heard this from them before. Yeah.
Yeah. So let me ask you this though. Do you think, like I said, it's having the opposite effect when they constantly, before Obama was elected, or maybe like even within the first 2 years, let's say, of his presidency, it was kind of like race was an out of sight, out of mind kind of thing. They did not want people thinking about race. They did not want white people thinking about race. Now, with all these media scandals, they're getting white people to think about race. And as it turns out, white people are starting to get sick of it. And they're starting to see that there's a crosshair on our back.
This is Hot Rise.
There's a tale that they tell down in Old Wolf County of a murderous husband and his family of three. One day a neighbor from over the hill, he found them dead in the cabin. It was so deathly still. The killer, he left a note, and I know how it read. I hope you don't find me, I'd rather be dead than to live in your jailhouse for the rest of my days. Until the jury it hangs me for my wicked way. Sometimes at night I wake to the sound of a man in the distance in the baying of hounds. Once on a full moon in the spring of the year, I heard breaking branches, footsteps so near.
It searched, it was 5 days and more. He hid in a cave by the steep river shore, till he gave himself up, he started walking downtown. Before he got to the courthouse, the man shot him down. He said, I'm not sorry for what I have done, but I cannot live like a man on a run. I'm glad that you killed me, you can make me my grave. It can't be much worse than that dark, lonely cave.
Okay, running long again, so I'll do a fairly quick wind-up here. More housekeeping, I guess you'd call it. I really hate this because my talking about money this much makes me sound like Jim Baker or Jimmy Swaggart or some of the televangelists. Anyway, here goes. Without getting into details as to the who or where or how much, there has been another episode of legacy theft, or at least one seems to be developing. I'm going to give all you elderly comrades out there some advice. Remember those little reminders and box ads you used to see all the time in Gerald L. K. Smith's Crossing the Flag, or Cardo's various publications, or John Birch Society Trek, about please remember us in your will? Well, don't. Don't bother to leave the Northwest Front or any other racial or revisionist group anything in your will, because your wishes will not be respected. The group you want to help will receive no money at all and will probably lose money on lawyers trying to obtain whatever you left them through the regime's court system. Now, this will happen when the decedent's vicious and dumbass liberal family gets involved and contests the will, because they don't want money going to us, that they need to complete that extension on their McMansion or clear the $50,000 student loan debt that their semi-retarded son living in the basement ran up to get his useless social sciences or media degree. Or else they want the money just out of plain orneriness and hatred of the old man for leaving it to you and not them in the first place. There have been a number of infamous incidents like this, the worst that I have any personal knowledge of being the Richard Cotter case, when Cotter died in Massachusetts and left about $250,000 to Ernst Zundel, and the Southern Poverty Law Center stepped in and either did the family's legal work for free or cut them some kind of sweetheart deal, I can't remember. So eventually the case ended up like Jarndyce versus Jarndyce in Charles Dickens's novel Bleak House. The legal expenses of litigation put the bequest into the pockets of the lawyers involved, and Ernst never saw a dime. But there have been other cases. In addition to fighting the Virginia lawsuit by Jim Ring's crew trying to stop him from selling off the West Virginia compound and sticking the proceeds in his pocket, Eric Gleeby is also fighting a case in Canada to get an inheritance that a Canadian guy left to the N.A. If I'm not mistaken, the Canadian government is actually fighting in the courts to prevent that bequest from being handed over on the grounds that wicked evil racism is quote-unquote against public policy. I can't remember if that's the exact story, but I do remember hearing that phrase in there somewhere, and there are numerous other cases like this as well. One thing the system does not want people like us having, and that is anything approaching actual capitalization, any kind of actual capital sum of money that we might use to build something professional. Look, if you have money, you want to go to the Northwest Front, or any other racial or revisionist group, not just us, you need to give it now, while you're still alive and you still have control of the assets.
Do not rely on your will. Do not rely on your heirs. Do not rely on your children. Do not rely on your attorneys. Give the money now, at a crucial time in history when groups like ours need it more than we ever have. But our time is up for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sarsha Andaban. Freedom. And in honor of the season, we'll close with a ghostly old ballad from Connie Dover. It's called The Holland Handkerchief.
She got on behind. get down, love, and go to bed. And I see this noble horse is groomed and fed. When she arrived at her father's hall, who's there, who's there? With a Holland handkerchief.